Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Cy Musiker, news anchor at KQED and co-host of The Duelist. You can find Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. From crafting handbags to designing the newest electronic devices, from making steel bikes to brewing beer and wine, San Franciscans are tapping into the deep well of creativity and expertise that exists here to build, brew, bake, and create. Tonight, we're here to explore the local marketplace, to discuss what, if any, benefits there are to buying local, and to debate the Bay Area's locavorian culture. And to talk about these issues, it's my pleasure to introduce tonight's panelists. On my right are Mark Dwight, founder of SF Made, a nonprofit focused on building San Francisco's manufacturing sector, and founder of Rickshaw Bagworks. Hutt Landon, executive director of the San Francisco Locally Owned Merchants Alliance. And Anne-Marie Brown, operations director and organizational Gandalf at La Cocina, which is focused on cultivating low-income food entrepreneurs to help them reach economic self-sufficiency by doing something they love to do. And to start, I want to ask each of you to talk briefly, please, about the work you do and how that ties in with tonight's theme about locavore culture and local manufacturing. And Mark, would you start for us?
Sure. So I'm Mark Dwight. I'm the founder of a local manufacturing business called Rickshaw Bagworks. We've been cutting and sewing down in our Dog Patch neighborhood here for 5.5 years. I'm also the founder and chairman of SF Made, an organization that is committed to not only supporting but growing the local manufacturing sector. And I'm also a small business commissioner on the City Hall Small Business Commission.
So what is that work, what does that that job tell you about the importance of locavore, of locally crafted goods? Why do you think that matters?
Well, I think, SF Made is a celebration of pride of place, but also of the importance of manufacturing and local manufacturing for creating a diverse and robust local economy. And I think also we are at kind of at what some are calling a revolution and what I call also a renaissance of micro-manufacturing. New technologies are allowing us to reconsider some of the manufacturing decisions we've been making over the last several decades, which are all oriented towards offshoring and mass manufacturing. And today, technologies are providing entrepreneurs with the opportunity to actually manufacture on smaller scale and locally. So.
And Hutt, the same question for you again. How does what you do, you're the executive director of the San Francisco Locally Owned Merchants Alliance, how does that, what insight does that give you into locally manufactured or locally retail goods?
Well, SF LOMA, which is the acronym that we'll use from now on so we save time. Our mission, it was started by locally owned merchants, and the mission is to identify for consumers, locally owned merchants, retailers, and locally owned businesses in the city. And then once we've identified them, to explain to the consumers and politicians and City Hall and the rest what the importance and the value of those businesses is to the city, and particularly the economic value. I think many people will say they like their local bookstore or hardware store, they like the neighborhood, but there are economic reasons why supporting locally owned businesses make a lot of sense. And I think what we're tasked with doing is getting that message out to the consumer, and it's a very powerful message, and it ties in to manufacturing and production as well, and it's a message that I think the public is more and more interested in hearing about as well.
Okay, and Anne-Marie Brown, you're at La Cocina, which works with a lot of immigrant entrepreneurs who want to have a food business especially.
Correct.
How does that fit into this idea about locavore culture?
Yeah, so at La Cocina, we really kind of focus on finding the hidden entrepreneurs that are out there. And so these are folks who might be operating informally currently, so cooking out of their homes or selling something on the street that might not quite be legal. And so we really look to try and move them from this kind of informal economy into the formal economy. So helping them access the resources that they need in order to contribute to the local economy and continue to support the local movement in that way.
And let me start with you, Anne-Marie.
Yeah.
What's the climate out there for getting a business loan? How easy is it, especially as compared to mm-hmm. the last couple of years during the recession?
Yeah. I mean, for our entrepreneurs, that is one of the most difficult things for them to be able to access, simply because some of them are immigrants. So in terms of having a credit history and being able to go through the formal loan process. So we actually work with a lot of nonprofits out there that do kind of alternative forms of lending or lend to those communities in general.
Does that mean microloans sometimes?
Some of those are microloans. Kiva Zip is one program that we work with. And so they offer, it's a lending-based kind of matching program where folks can sign up to be a member and basically invest $25 in a business, and then they get that back. Working Solutions is another organization. And opportunity funds. So those are ones that we partner with and that can help support our entrepreneurs in getting that access to capital.
Let me ask you the same question. What about getting access to capital?
Well, I think that in the retail world, it's an issue as it is in both of these other worlds. I think what small business groups and organizations in general have tried to do is to work with government. The Small Business Administration has actually started to do much more. I remember sitting in at a meeting, and the head of the SBA was there, and she was talking about wanting to support small businesses. And you can get $1 million loan, no problem, if you have the right paperwork. And we're all looking and said, we need 50,000. A million is way out. And so part of it is having them understand what a small business really is. To them, it was up here. And for a lot of people, a small business is, that thing. So microloans, all the rest. I think we're interested as much as anything in educating the people that do make loans about what a microloan and actually on smaller amounts. Oddly enough, it's easier to get more money than less money sometimes.
Okay, and how about you, Mark?
Well, like any business, manufacturing businesses operate on certain fundamentals that the bankers are always going to look at in your loan application. I think an important role that SF Made is playing is helping play the matchmaker role between financial institutions and local businesses, and in this case, local manufacturing businesses. And I think you're also seeing kind of the reassertion of the community bank. Community banks are really important because they become much more intimately familiar with the local business climate, the local entrepreneurs, and take a much more focused interest in the specific businesses themselves, so they learn more about it. So we're not just a manufacturing sector business, check the box. We are Mark Dwight running a sewing factory in Dogpatch. What does that mean? Is Dogpatch special? Is what Mark's doing special? And so we still have to meet all of the basic financial criteria, but there's a little more knowledge about who we are, what we do, and whether we're a good credit risk or not.
Are there resources for at SF Made or at La Cocina for how to write a good business plan? Because that is the key. I think both you mentioned that. You have to present a business plan to the lenders.
Well, SF Made has a variety of programs to help both entrepreneurs and established business owners to fine-tune their businesses, better understand their finances. It's very common in businesses where the owner's an expert, of course, in their field, but they may not be an expert in finance. And so we discuss whether it makes sense to go out and hire a financial, someone with finance experience within your company, or to hire a consultant who maybe you're sharing with other manufacturers. At Rickshaw, we're still a small business, and we use a financial consultant who gives us CFO services when we need it, but more often bookkeeping and controller services when we need them. So,
yeah, and I just want to also note that in San Francisco, Mark's aware of this on the board, the Office of Small Business exists and is a huge resource for
San Francisco Office of Small Business.
Yes, the San Francisco Office of Small Business, which is really it's an important resource, and it's one that we all push to keep funding for and the rest, but they have a lot of resources, and I think that a lot of people don't necessarily know about it.
They're kind of buried. They're lost in this little in the tax offices, I believe. That's where they used to be. But things are getting better.
Well, I think they are, and it's important that people understand that the resources there, and they've done a huge job in streamlining things to make it easier for people to find out about loans, to get permits, all that kind of thing. And that it's a really valuable resource that the city is, has access to.
And Anne-Marie, just briefly about that process, writing a business plan, mm-hmm. and then how good is San Francisco at working with your entrepreneurs?
Yeah, so at La Cocina, in order to apply to our program, we do encourage entrepreneurs to actually go through. There's many amazing organizations that are out there that do that specific business planning. So All Us, Women's Initiative, Renaissance Center, SBA, there's lots and lots of wonderful organizations out there doing that. Once in La Cocina, we then work to kind of target and hone that business plan for food businesses because it's so specific. So to make sure that they are thinking about their business in the right way so that when they launch, that they are launching successfully. Because I think that's one of the most important things, especially in starting a small business, making sure you're kind of putting all your ducks in a row to begin with, especially if you're have capital constraints. You don't have the money to really be able to test the idea out when you get going.
Well, you don't have the money to fail.
It's true, absolutely.
I suppose it must be awful to work for months or years to set up a business, and then because you've forgotten something important,
exactly.
have something, you fail, you trip.
Correct.
Yeah. This might be a question for you, Mark. To what degree do conventional capital sources meet the needs of manufacturing businesses? You mentioned community banks, but are there problems with conventional capital sources?
Well, if you look at sort of the venture side of the equation, manufacturing businesses don't tend, especially in this area that's so technology intensive, to meet the interest level, let alone the sort of growth criteria that typical venture capitalists will look for. That being said, because there has been so much wealth generated in this area, there are a lot of angel investors. And a lot of angel investors today, though they made their money in technology, are taking a keen interest in food and beverage and in manufacturing, mostly in consumer products where they have seen great successes, especially as we've seen open forums like Kickstarter where people are openly displaying their ideas, having the public respond to them, and people can see viscerally, wow, they just raised $1 million for a product idea or in some case $10 million for a software idea. So that's attracting the attention of angel investors, not so much institutional investors because they're investing much larger sums of money in bigger deals.
Right. What about production spaces? And I'm thinking this is more about manufacturing, but perhaps also mm-hmm. for kitchens, specialized kitchens, production space and a skilled workforce. Maybe we can come back to workforce. How about production space?
Well, production space is always a challenge. Manufacturing companies generally start rather small. They may be contracting with a local company, and then when they want to ramp up their own production, finding adequate space, especially in a city like San Francisco that is literally 49 square miles, there's no more of it than that, and most of that space is either high rent areas where people want to or have already built condominiums and high rent offices, or where the buildings are vacant and are waiting to be converted into those higher use forms. We have taken some steps in San Francisco to define some areas where production, distribution, and wholesale type businesses can exist in our eastern neighborhoods, as we call it. And the Port Authority is developing a large project, Pier 70, which will make available to artisanal manufacturers some new space. So right now, we're sort of on the outskirts of the city. I will say that small-scale manufacturers like to be in mixed-use areas where there is some residential. At companies like mine, we have a factory store, so we want some local retail activity. And so it's oftentimes hard to find a warehouse surrounded by homes and retail institutions.
Well, in fact, in my neighborhood where KQED is, 2601 mm-hmm. Mariposa, yep. we're between the Mission and Portrero, and there are a number of small manufacturers there.
Well, Heath Ceramics perfect, just recently.
Right, Heath maybe. Ceramics. So that's a perfect example of what you're talking about, a mix of residential. But it's ironic, isn't it, because, say, 25 years ago or so, 30 years ago perhaps, there was a lot of empty space yes. because manufacturing was leaving San Francisco, mm-hmm. and now everybody wants to live in those empty lofts or convert them into apartments. Mm-hmm. So you're fighting this, you're fighting to turn back 2 decades worth of history.
It is a challenge. SF Made actually is providing some great matchmaking services there. The Heath Ceramics is a fantastic example. Heath SF Made brokered the relationship between the building owners of the old Mission Laundry building, 60,000 square feet of abandoned building, to have it converted into Heath's new ceramics manufacturing facility, which is a ceramics manufacturing factory, a cafe, and a demonstration kitchen, and a beautiful store. So it's a model of kind of redevelopment that can go on around a micro manufacturer. And manufacturing is theatrical, and it's amazing to see. You know, they've glassed in the area where they're manufacturing ceramics, and there's kilns going there. They're moving, you know, carts in and out of the kilns with fired and glazed beautiful pottery, and it's fascinating to watch. And you can have your blue bottle coffee at the same time.
Right, they have an outlet there. Well, let me start this question with you, Anne-Marie.
Yeah.
And what about a skilled workforce? Because an entrepreneur who's very successful with food making is going to want to start to hire somebody so they're not working 24 hours a day. How easy is it to find smart people to work, do the work?
Yeah, I mean, for most of our entrepreneurs, that is a process that comes along a little bit farther down the line, and so closer to what we call graduation. So when they're reaching that economic self-sufficiency, so they can start hiring more people to be able to do that. But it definitely is a challenge, and especially, too, if you're working on a small scale or starting out as a caterer who has a job or two a month, finding that labor to be able to come in and help you out in the kitchen or help at those different events is definitely something that is pretty challenging in keeping those folks engaged.
We hear sometimes about the split in the workforce. So another couple of years from now, another 8 years from now, for some people in the U.S., mm-hmm. the recession will still be, they'll still be in the recession because they lack the skills for today's more highly skilled, more technology-dependent jobs, perhaps a higher education or whatever else it takes, mm-hmm. a more sophisticated approach to what kind of work you might do. And I just wonder, is it in the Bay Area, are we a place that mostly draws these higher skilled workers and fewer people who want to have a blue collar job, who want to just come in, punch a clock, and get paid decently to do that?
I mean, I think that there's a mix of both of that in our kind of local economy here. I mean, there's, yes, absolutely, a lot more of those folks who are coming in. But, you know, I mean, I think for our organization, it's definitely about ensuring that there is an economic place for folks who might not have that access or have that experience, and allowing them to do something that they love to do, that they are able to support their families, that they are able to make a living doing it in a way that also then benefits all of us in terms of the wonderful food that we have access to, right, that we might not have normally.
And how about, let me ask you, Mark, it seems like a question exactly for you, finding a skilled workforce to make the bags at Rickshaw or for some of your other SF Made clients.
Well, I'm fortunate that San Francisco has a rich sewing history. So when we ran our first ad for two sewers, 400 people showed up at our building. So there are a lot of sewers out there. It was a rather depressing testament to the state of the sewing industry in San Francisco.
What year was that?
That was just 5 years ago.
Uh-huh.
So... but, you know, we train people on the job. I think one of the interesting things about artisanal manufacturing, craft-oriented manufacturing businesses, is that these skills can be trained. And these are jobs for people who might not be interested in technology, you know, purely technology businesses. Not everybody's cut out to be or wants to be a programmer or a bioscientist or something like that. So I think it's vitally important that we try and restore some of the diversity to our local jobs and our workforce. So.
And how about you, Farhad? Now, I'm sorry if this question doesn't fit your kind of work that your members take part in. But.
Yeah, it's really not. I mean, working in retail does require certain skills. It is trainable, the one thing that I would note is that. Retailers, but locally owned businesses of all kind are the jobs engine. And I think what's important is that if you have manufacturers, you've got people interested in getting into food business, whatever it is, that there are resources to help them do it, because that's where the job growth, you know, if and when it happens, will come from. It's from these local entrepreneurs and local businesses. It means historically, that's where job growth comes from. So it's important for all of us to do what we can as organizations to help with training, with identifying people in the workforce that can do the various jobs that they need to do, and to provide this training. I mean, what La Cocina's does just is, you know, so important. And, you know, those businesses wouldn't exist in 6 months without them, literally.
Here's a question just for you, Hutt, and it's taking us back a little bit toward our locally made theme. What is the value of a local business? Buying it, say, a Books, Inc., which is a locally owned small chain, mini chain, versus a Borders, or not that they exist anymore.
That's right.
but a chain store, right. Or buying online at Amazon. What's the value of buying locally?
Well, there's all sorts of value in terms of quality of life. I think most people who live in San Francisco don't live here for the real estate prices. But this is a city of neighborhoods, and people who live in neighborhoods, you know, live there purposefully. And part of what makes a neighborhood vibrant and accessible is the commercial, you know, the shopping area. You know, whether it's a 24th Street or a West Portal or the Marina, you know, there are, you know, dozens really of these neighborhoods. And so the local businesses in particular, partly because of the size of the city, as Mark said, it's 7x7. You only got a certain amount of space. You can't build 25,000 square foot big box stores in any case. Mm-hmm. So it tends to be smaller businesses. And so there's the sort of the culture. You live in a neighborhood, you can walk to the local bookstore, hardware store, that neighbor, the restaurants. That's part of it. But the piece that a lot of people don't know about is that a lot of economic studies have been done now over the last 10 years that show that locally owned businesses give back to the local economy, reinvest at 2.5 to 3 times the amount. And just to make it easy for you, if you spend $100 with a locally owned business, $68 of that $100 is reinvested back in the economy. You take that same $100 and you spend it in a chain store, $43 is reinvested. And if you spend it online, especially with a company like Amazon that up until 2 months ago wasn't even collecting sales tax in the state, it's much less. Mm-hmm. So the economic reinvestment, and when you think about it, locally owned businesses are using local architects, local web designers, they're probably buying their supplies at the local, you know, using the local coffee shop, whatever. A chain store does all that at the corporate headquarters. So that's the part of the reinvesting. I tell people, if you work at Stonestown and you go out to lunch in Stonestown, you will eat at a chain store. You have no choice, even if you want to. That's all that's there. If you're working on 24th Street and Dogpatch, you have lots of choices. So there's one example of, you know, two brothers. One works at Stonestown, one works in Dogpatch. The one in Dogpatch at a locally owned business is reinvesting his money at lunch in a locally owned. And that's just a small example, but that happens everywhere, and there is a huge economic benefit to that.
So let me stay with you. So Paragon Mall, the outlet mall, is opening out, I guess it's in Livermore.
Yes.
There was a story in the Chronicle. Yeah. Certainly I've been getting peppered with emails, I should be covering this or whatever. There's been ads in the Chronicle. You're telling me that the economic value of that is different from the economic value of a strip of stores that are locally owned.
Of course, yeah. Sure there is. I mean, just think about. I mean, if you think about a big chain store that's publicly owned, the money, literally. You know, Mark puts his money in the bank, in whatever bank it is, every night, and the chain store does the same thing. The difference is Mark's money stays in that bank for a little while. The chain store's the money from the chain store goes straight to corporate headquarters, wherever it is. It doesn't even stay in Wells Fargo, you know, for any length of time. I mean, it really is, the money does not stay and reinvest in the city. And I think when you think about that notion of the symbiotic relationship between the consumer and their money and the business, and you see that it really can make a huge difference.
Let me stay on this theme, and I think this is the way the question is meant. Manufacturing, food, retail, housing create kind of an economic ecosystem? And I'm thinking of a neighborhood, the kind you were just describing. Is it possible to encourage or recreate these ecosystems? And I guess this is really, in a way, a question. Let me start with you, Anne-Marie. Do you have in mind the idea that when you send your entrepreneurs out, that they're going to help create a new neighborhood? Maybe I think that goes to the ideal behind this question.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that the idea is that they're going to create a new neighborhood, but they're going to add vibrancy to a neighborhood, right? I mean, actually, we at Rickshaw, we did a partnership where we had some of our entrepreneurs come and do a lunch at their factory, so to feed the workers there as well as around the neighborhood, which, you know, so the ways that we can kind of start to introduce the entrepreneurs to the local economy, to consumers that are out there, to help them build up not only their business, but also kind of just give them a sense of what that kind of feels like to be out there in the world.
And how about you at SF Made? Do you ever think of it in those terms?
Oh, absolutely. My own company, for example, we use a half a dozen companies within, I would say, a mile radius of our business to do various embellishment things like embroidery and cutting some of our fabric and doing digital printing and screen printing. And then, of course, any collateral we would have printed is done locally. And so there is that notion of an economic ecosystem supporting the businesses that we're in. A very interesting issue in food and beverage is presently one of the things that we really lack in San Francisco is a co-packer. Mm-hmm. So we have a lot of people starting artisanal food businesses, not restaurants, but wanting to do canning and make beverages and things of that nature. And generally, a lot of these businesses wouldn't start their own factory. They'd go to a co-packing facility, someone who is in the business of doing beverages or doing canning or bottling.
I think FRS, which makes sports drinks, mm-hmm. down in Foster City, they didn't do any of their own packing. They
should, correct.
That was all done at other food manufacturing plants.
And many craft brewers are contracting their brewing. We fortunately have a number of craft brewers here in the city who are brewing their own in their own facilities. But this is something that SF Made is taking a particular interest right now in trying to attract some co-packaging companies back into the city. There used to be some here, but they've all moved out to Fremont and Oakland and places like that, and we'd like to bring some back in the city limits to facilitate some of these businesses that, as they're incubated, we don't want them leaving the city because they get too big, you know, for what we have to offer here in San Francisco.
Okay, here's a good question for all three of you, and I hope it's not too early in the evening to ask this. How do you tell someone their idea is bad? Clear Pepsi, another bacon froyo cupcake stand, a bag made of feathers. How do you tell someone their idea is bad? Let me start with you, Mark.
Well, today I could just say, you know, you ought to try that on Kickstarter and see what people say about it.
So
no harm, no foul.
You know, right, if you crowdsource it, you'll, and nobody shows up.
I mean, we do. Works. As a manufacturer and as a consumer brand, we get many entrepreneurs coming our way. And as someone who has been in business for a while, and so people, you know, often the entrepreneur will look out to people that they think have already been successful in business and say, hey, you know, what do you think of my idea? Or, you know, and so I tell anyone who comes our way, I will tell you from my perspective what I think, and I'll just be candid. And if I don't think it's right for some kind of a collaboration with my business, then I'll tell you someone I think it might be. Or I'll tell you just what I've seen in the world and why I think either this idea has been tried before and didn't make it. Not to say it couldn't. Maybe the time wasn't right. Maybe it's time for the idea now. Many ideas have been invented a long time ago and reemerged in a different context and been successful. You never want to necessarily take the wind out of the sails of an entrepreneur who's excited about their idea. But on the other hand, everyone needs a little tough love now and then.
Right. And how about you?
Well, I would pass the buck in a sense, as Mark's kind of saying. Someone came to me with an idea for a retail business. Do you have a business plan? Have you been to a financial institution and asked them if they would loan you money? If the answer is yes to both those, and I think it's a bad idea, I'd say go for it. And if the answer is no, and it probably is if it really isn't a good idea. You know, that's it. I think the thing that's really important for any in any of these fields is that someone who loves to, you know, to cook, to bake, and they, you know, want to do it. This is something we learned in the book world, frankly, the independent bookselling world. 30 years ago, it was, you know, this wonderful thing, and then the chains came in and Amazon came in. And what we said is, if you can't run a business, if you don't run it as a business, whatever it is, you're not gonna make it. The world is too competitive in all fields. And I think my advice would not be, you know, this is going to make it or not make it. I think look at it as a business, not as I love to bake and I can get this out. If you don't know how to get it out to the consumer in a way that makes sense business-wise, then you're not going to make it. And I think that's the key thing.
I'm going to kill that idea for a restaurant.
It's also true that very few businesses look the same 3 years later. A lot of it is just getting started. And so you get started, you get your first idea out there, you get feedback, you change your idea or modify your design in response to the feedback of your customer, whether it's a consumer or a business to business. And so, you know, most businesses look a lot different 3 to 5 years down the road. Either they're non-existent, whereas the entrepreneur said, "Well, that was a bad idea, and I don't know where to go with from here." Or an entrepreneur has said, "That's good feedback. I'm going to modify my idea." Generally, if you're passionate and you have perseverance, but also you are listening to what you're hearing from the marketplace, you can modify your business.
Okay. Did you want to jump in on this, or?
No, I mean, I agree absolutely. I mean, I think too, for us, in terms of like success isn't always the entrepreneur who starts the business and makes the business, but even sometimes the entrepreneur who realizes that they're not going to be able to meet what their goals are or what their objectives are, and so that they don't spend the 3 years struggling and trying and climbing and losing a lot of money and a lot of time, but they get to realize that sooner rather than later, which can be
in the incubator environment where it doesn't cost them a lot of money.
Exactly.
Let's come back to this locally produced issue. Are people willing to pay more for local products or for locally retailed products? And what's the breaking point for that? In other words, how much more are they willing to pay? Anne-Marie?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. I think that there is a certain level that folks are, especially given the Bay Area and just the knowledge in terms of the consumer base that we have here around local products. Again, in terms of our entrepreneurs that we work with, it's something that we like to talk a lot about in terms of going through, talking about sourcing,
and how much to charge, right?
Yeah, absolutely. How much to charge? Really looking at that, what their target market is, right? Who are their customers? Who are the ones that need to be targeting, and what's important to them? And really thinking through that and how they're building their products and costing and sourcing their products. So in that case, I think there is a market place for it, and some of our entrepreneurs it works that way, and some others the folks that they're selling to, it isn't necessarily important to them.
All right, and Hunt, tell me, why am I going to go to Books Inc.? I live in Alameda. Why do I go to Books Inc. on Park Street instead of buying it for 20% less on Amazon?
Because one, the money stays in the community. Two, you want Books Inc. to stay there because you like going there. And, you know, the consumer has the choice here. You don't have to shop, but if you want a store, a restaurant, any business to survive because it's important to you, you have to support it. You can't just say, oh, I'll go once every couple of years, and then suddenly there's a for sale and say, what happened? What happened is you didn't show up. Now, whatever the reason is, if it matters to you, so I would argue that if Books Inc. gives you a shopping experience that matters to you, then you need to support it. If you don't care and you're saving the 20%, except you're paying shipping, and Amazon is using a truck to ship that to you, so the environmental impact is much higher. Same thing with a food thing. Is it more expensive to buy something in your neighborhood as opposed to getting in your car and driving and getting it, you know, 20 cents cheaper somewhere else? Is that really, what's really the cost? And it isn't just the actual money, it's the whole, you know, ecosystem that's involved. And shopping locally saves, environmentally, it's quality of life issues, all sorts of things that get involved in that.
But does that mean that if you actually make that calculation, the emissions and environmental benefits and community benefits calculation, and then you're willing to pay that 5 or 10 or 20 or 30% more. But does that mean also, though, that only the upper class can afford a locally made good? I'm being devil's advocate here.
Well, it depends. Yeah. I mean, it depends on, you know, what you're talking about. One of the things that sort of a dirty little secret about the chain stores about going to Target down at the Metreon now.
Or out at the old Sears store in Hungary.
Perhaps, Masonic. Yes. That's going to be more of a fight, I think. One of the dirty secrets is that the chain stores are so competitive, the big chains, the Targets, the Walmarts, Amazon, all the rest, that they put so much pressure on manufacturers. Even, you know, if they were selling rickshaw bags, they would tell Mark he needs to give it to them at this price. And Mark would probably say, I can't make it at that price.
That's I mean,
this, this no, and this happens all the time. And they say, well, then we're not going to sell it. So you, the manufacturer, say, well, I got to have Walmart or I can't survive. And so what you do is you make a lesser product, literally. And there are studies that show this time and time again. And so what happens is you save $5 buying, you know, whatever it is, except that it wears out faster. And you end up, over the course of your lifetime, spending more on that same product because it's actually, with the same label, same name, same everything, it's an inferior product. And manufacturers will tell you they have to do that to cut corners in order to get the product into those stores. So are you really saving money? You're not buying, it's not apples to apples. You're not actually buying the same thing. When you buy rickshaw bags, you know what you get.
Well, let me ask a slightly different question. Some people have challenged the whole idea of sourcing locally, whether it's food or handbags, saying that global economies like the U.S. need globally scaled manufacturing so that you can get a rickshaw quality bag if you made 100 times as many a year, perhaps, or food. Producing, you know, you get the advantages of large scale manufacturing are quality, price, and surety of supply. Is that a fair challenge to the idea of locally sourced?
I don't think so. I think many of the goods we're talking about are not essential goods. I mean, I'm not selling, you know, drinking water or basic essentials. I'm selling a discretionary product. And frankly, the fact that there isn't an unlimited supply of that product enhances its desirability. Consumer products is all about differentiation. I'm in a multi-billion-dollar market for bags. I'm tiny, and my objective as a small business person is not to sell as many bags as possible. It's just to sell as many bags as necessary to run the kind of business that I want to manage. I don't want to be the king of the bag business. It's very stressful. I don't want to sell to Walmart. That's very stressful. I'm not suggesting that the entrepreneur who does want to supply Walmart. I mean, that's a special skill. That's not a skill that I have or that I'm interested in. I'm interested in selling specialized product to consumers that want to engage with the story that we have to tell, the who, what, why, where, and how behind the products that they purchase. And I don't expect them to have that same desire for everything they purchase. They might not care on their commodity goods. They want, you know, the right value, the cheapest price, or, you know, the softest tissue or whatever. But when they come to buy something that's discretionary, they might make a choice. Well, I want something local. Are they buying it because it's local, or are they buying it because they can come and meet my team and see the product being made, or come in and choose their colors, or bring me a fabric and have me make that bag special for them, or put an embroidery on it that's special to them? So these are ways of slicing and dicing markets. I would not propose to someone, or if someone came to me with the idea, as you asked earlier, that they wanted to make a commodity product in San Francisco, and that commodity was being made also in a low-cost offshore facility somewhere, I would say, well, you've just selected the most expensive place in the world to manufacture. We have the highest minimum wage in the United States here in San Francisco. We have the highest real estate prices, probably the top three in the United States, and we have a limited supply of everything. So why do you want to do that here in San Francisco?
This shows why you're such a terrible manufacturer. Such a bad business plan, doesn't it?
So I think for small-scale artisanal manufacturing and specialty services and specialty foods, it makes total sense to serve a local market, especially in a place like San Francisco where it isn't just the locals. It is the people that come from the outside to visit this special place called San Francisco as tourists. And we have a steady stream of people coming in and out of our economy here every single day that want to take something home with them, either in their bellies or on their shoulder or whatever, that speaks to this experience they had here, whether it was made here, whether it was cooked here, or whether it simply had a graphic on it that was created someplace else but spoke to their experience in San Francisco. And we'd like to think that making it here gave it even more soul.
Right. Well, I'd hate to buy a cable car, a model cable car that's made in China. I have a reminder for our radio audiences now. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Today we're discussing the many things produced here in the Bay Area and the impact of fostering local business and entrepreneurship. We're here with Mark Dwight, founder of SF Made, a nonprofit focused on building San Francisco's manufacturing sector, and the founder of Rickshaw Bagworks. Hutt Landon is executive director of the San Francisco locally owned Merchants Alliance, and Anne-Marie Brown, operations director and organizational Gandalf at La Cucina, a local organization focused on cultivating low-income food entrepreneurs and helping them to be successful and to reach economic self-sufficiency by doing something they love to do. I'm Cy Musiker, a news anchor at KQED and co-host of The Do List, and we have some more questions from our audience here. Why do you think most food businesses, is a question from Jill, why do you think most food businesses fail, and what can our local community do to better support them in the beginning?
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of food businesses fail precisely because they probably just start running with their idea before really understanding and looking at the market, right? The market place, you know, is there even room in the market for this particular product or what you're doing? I think a lot of it comes from that notion of I love to cook or I love to bake, you know, like this is my passion, I love to do it, oh, I can make a living doing it. We are in the business of helping people make a living doing what they love to do, but it doesn't mean that everybody can actually succeed in that realm. And so you do really have to look at what your target market is. Who are the people that you're selling to? How are you going to make money doing this? What are your goals, right? I mean, in terms of for small businesses and a lot of the entrepreneurs we work with, the goal in terms of what they're looking to make isn't something that a tech company employee might be looking to make, or this isn't another Facebook or get-rich scheme. And so really kind of thinking through what that looks like, understanding the marketplace, understanding kind of how you're going to enter. So it's to us, it's that plan. Coming up with that plan is what can be most successful. And I think as consumers, you know, just talking about the local economy and supporting local business, it's just so important and really adds, I think, to our own lives, right? We get to experience things that are new and different and it isn't just another box store out there.
It's a good question for Hutt. What is the value of such tools as local currency and commercial rent control? I think it's a separate question. So let me ask first about local currency.
Well, local currency is a very interesting idea. It's a little more complicated sometimes than it appears. The idea that you can, in a neighborhood or a community, you know, it's almost like bartering. You all, you know, use this system.
Yeah, I have a card, Alameda Buys, and it gets me a discount on products in Alameda.
Right, and that's a little different. That's actually not local currency. That's more like a loyalty card kind of thing. And that's a little easier to set up. Everybody agrees to give a discount or a value-added something. Local currency is a little trickier because of the nature of business. You know, people's cash register systems work differently than others. I mean, it's a good idea in theory, and it has worked in communities. We've looked into it in San Francisco, and it just seems like an overwhelming task to get everybody sort of on the same page.
Because it involves in some form or another some kind of barter. To turn your dollars into this local currency.
Right. Yeah. Right. And I mean, it's easy for the consumer. It's not necessarily easy for all the businesses. And do you do it in the same? You know, is everybody valued the same way? It's a little tricky. Commercial real estate is.
Yeah. How about commercial rent control?
Careful.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know that I wouldn't. I don't want to comment on commercial rent control. I think that's just, there's too much going on. What I do think is, and one of the things that I would love to have the city do more with developers and, you know, and people who own commercial property is to think about options. You mentioned the target on, you know, that may go in at
Sears.
Geary and Masonic, the
yes.
old Sears and Mervyn's location. Right. And everybody says, well, it's 25,000 square feet, whatever it is, so it's got to be a big box. Mm. Does it? Could it be 5,000, whatever the math is, 2,500 square feet stores and create a kind of a thing? Could it be a mixed use? Could it be a warehouse space? This notion that because it's always been this one thing and that big is always the best, I'm not sure that's, I don't think anybody's ever looked at, you know, what are the alternatives? What happens if you put in 10 or 12 small businesses and you create it in that space with parking and everything? All these different businesses that would draw and would be businesses that were locally owned, hopefully, and that serve the needs, underserved, you know, products, whatever. I just don't think people are thinking in those ways. And I also think landlords also don't think about the fact that, you know, I'm just going to, I want the chain store, the big store, because they'll pay the higher rents.
Or I don't have to deal with 10 or 15.
That's right. But maybe there are ways to put tenants. Together a... Maybe you put together, you know, an ombudsman sort of type thing. But I think just in general, when you see in neighborhoods, Valencia Street's going through this, where people want, landlords want higher and higher rents. And the problem is that once you establish the level, instead of here, it's up to here, you just knock out, you know, most of the businesses we deal with. And the problem is that, you know, not every chain store makes it either. And suddenly you have these big empty spaces. And I think if you look at the world in the last 5 years and you look at Borders and Good Guys and Circuit City and, I mean, all across clothing companies, the chains aren't doing that well. I would argue that the local businesses are a better deal. And I think you have to just change the way you're thinking about neighborhoods and things. And that, you know, someone who owns a building gets to do what they want with it. But I think if people thought about it in a different way and the planning department said, you know, well, maybe we ought to give an incentive to someone for being creative instead of giving them an incentive for bringing in the big box that everybody says is the right answer. Not necessarily.
Mark, for you, let me turn that question about commercial rent control. So what happens if somebody has a good manufacturing space and then the rents start going up because the neighborhood becomes transformed into, like the Mission has over the last 15 or 20 years, it's become gentrified, and rents are much higher than they used to be.
Well, this is a significant issue in the Dogpatch neighborhood where I'm currently located. It is an up-and-coming neighborhood. There are a good number of condominium developments going on right now, and clearly, you know, Mission Bay development has pushed good-paying jobs and a lot of people who are working down into our area, and it's greatly changing the landscape in the Dogpatch and Potrero Hill area. Rents are going up, and you know one of the things is that we have a number of landlords in our area who have families own the buildings. American Industrial Center is a great example. It's hundreds of thousands of square feet that used to be an old can factory, and the owners of that building have subdivided it up into flexible spaces that can be made larger or smaller, and there are numerous entrepreneurs, everything from designers to bakers, chocolate makers, brewers in that facility. It's a rabbit warren of entrepreneurial activity. But that landlord, through the .com 1.0 and subsequent rises and falls, kept his rents reasonable, didn't jack them up opportunistically, and hence has kept many people who would have fled to Oakland or Emeryville or someplace like that.
So even though they had the opportunity to raise rents, might have made more money temporarily,
yep.
You think that they made more money in the long term because they kept rates?
Or they made the same amount of money.
Yep.
Many buildings went vacant. We had a horrible vacancy rate here in the last 5 to 8 years. After 2000, 2001, the aftermath of the .com implosion the first time around, a lot of and rents were astronomical, and then they just fell through the floorboards, and many of those buildings sat vacant for years. So all you have to do is average that out, and places like the American Industrial Center stayed rented. Today you can't get space there; it's all rented up. And what's interesting is that people want to now be in that neighborhood because all of these other things are going on, And when we go to the local cafe, we see Michael Ricciuti of Ricciuti Chocolate. We see Ledbetter, who's making his great English muffins. We see designers. We see software developers, all entrepreneurs that we know. And it's just a vibrant community. And lots of small businesses make for a very robust economy. You know, as you say, one big tenant moves out, you know, there's a big hole in the floorboards. If one small business goes out of business, then, you know, it's not so catastrophic.
And I'll bet that building is well maintained also.
Oh, yeah.
The notion of having a tenant for 10, 20 years is a huge, another cost that you don't think about, the cost of replacement. I bet those people love that building and they keep it, you know, maintained and painted and all the rest.
I'm in an 8,000 square foot warehouse that might not exist except for the fact that it's a family-owned business that's been in the city for 50 years. So, and I asked if I could buy the building, and the guy said, no, you'll have to buy it from whoever inherits it because I'm not selling it. So I figure I'm good for as long as he's healthy.
That's right.
Big chain stores have a clear advantage through mass advertising to drive consumer purchasing behavior. But Marcus in our audience asks, what are your thoughts to help smaller local businesses capture consumers' attention enough to compete? How do smaller businesses compete for ad space?
The internet.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, that is a
That's
big
a
part.
Secret. That's your secret. Nobody else knows.
I think
that.
There's no better time yeah. than the present to be an entrepreneur. Technology has allowed niche marketers to reach a global marketplace to find that customer, no matter where they live. And communicate with them effortlessly across the internet. And so clearly, being on the internet is not free. You have to buy AdWords. There's all kinds of techniques that you have to use to market yourself on the internet, as you would in any traditional sense. But it's a lot more economical, and the reach is global. And so today, someone with an idea that may have only a few customers here and a few customers there and a few customers there can aggregate those customers almost effortlessly across the internet. And, you know, those customers will seek you out through searching, and then you can also target them with increasingly sophisticated targeting technologies.
And one other, and I know we're getting tight, but the perfect example of the food people, the other important thing is to compete with the right message. And the message often isn't that you're going to match the price mm-hmm. of the big chain. That's not how small businesses, certainly retail businesses, compete. You compete, in addition to all the other things we've been talking about, in customer service, in experience, in creating a bagel or a cupcake that no one else can do. And so it's not about the price. It's about the experience of what you're getting.
Experience.
And I think that's a big part of starting a business is knowing how to market yourself. And I think one of the things that we're preaching and all of us are is that, you know, you're not like the chain stores, and that's not how we compete, and that's not what we're about. And it shouldn't be what we're about. If it's just about price, we don't win. But it shouldn't just be about price.
And Marie, I know a tweet using Twitter has been a huge advantage for street food
yes.
vendors. Do you teach people how to use Twitter?
So we do work with our entrepreneurs with social media. So Facebook, Twitter, all of those. I mean, just from an organizational standpoint, when we started the Street Food Festival, our marketing budget was
$300. Which is impossible to go to because it's so packed with people, right?
Oh, it's so big now.
Yeah.
You can get in.
Yeah.
We've got 85 vendors now. But yeah, so but that event.
And
I
what
mean,
did you spend at the beginning?
We spent, I think, $500 on marketing, and for what we thought was a one block party, and 12,000 people showed up.
Right.
So right there, the power of kind of social media, and just really, I think those, and again, it's tapping into the right networks, right? These entrepreneurs aren't competing with the big stores and the big advertisers. It just, that's, you know, you don't want to be in Walmart. You don't really need to try and reach out to the people who are shopping at Walmart. So, you know, right. really being strategic in who you are targeting and making sure that, again, your dollars count.
I frankly don't think most small business owners are preoccupied with competition.
Yeah.
Preoccupation with competition is one of the least creative forms of marketing there is. Mm-hmm. Because basically what it says is that you're comparing yourself to others rather than saying, well, what am I providing to my customers? What differentiates me?
Right.
We frankly don't even think about competition at my company. I mean,
It sounds like socialists talking.
And, well, no, and not to be sort of flippant about it, but if we preoccupied ourselves with that, we would, you know, we're designing products primarily for ourselves because we are our market. We're urban commuters who are traveling by bicycle or by muni or walking or whatever. And so we design for ourselves, and we figure there's enough people out there like us to sustain our business. I don't want actually to get in the ring with some of the larger competitors, if you will, in my marketplace. I'm just going to get a bloody nose. I know that.
Yeah.
So I'm just not going to even focus on that. I'm going to go do what I do and test my ideas on a marketplace where people are receptive to my ideas, and they're going to respond. They're either going to buy it or they're going to say, you know, I'd buy that if it was this way. And then I might change it and say, well, great, I'm going to buy it now. But I don't say, well, how do I stack up? You know, it's called check-the-box marketing. Do I have that? Do I have that? Do I have that? That's not very creative. And then, frankly, you end up looking a lot like your competition if all you do is check the boxes.
A couple quick questions. I want to make sure the audience's questions are included. And maybe this is mostly for Mark. But what opportunities are there for exporting San Francisco-made products to Asia, South America, or Europe? And then somebody tweaks that question by asking about alliances with San Francisco's sister cities, Shanghai, Paris, Krakow. Are there opportunities for export, and especially with San Francisco's sister communities?
Absolutely, and I think you can define exporting in two different ways. Exporting can be done by someone coming here and buying something and taking it with them. That is a profitable form of exporting in my business. Actually, exporting through distribution networks is a very difficult business in consumer products because you end up having a lot of mouths in the food chain, if you will. Mm-hmm. You've got to pay your distributor. They might be a stocking distributor. You've got transportation costs. And ultimately, you either raise your prices to the point where they're sort of ridiculously expensive in a foreign market, or you have your margins just don't work. And so that's why I think the internet is so important, is because now customers in Japan and elsewhere can get to me through the internet. I have a good website that allows you to buy the products, and we have guaranteed shipping and things like that. And so, or you come to San Francisco and you take something home with you. I think there's huge value in people being able to come to a local place, whether it's San Francisco or New York or Peoria, and buy something that somehow is special, whether it was made there or whether it was designed there, but something that speaks to what is essential or different about that place. And all snow globes are made in China, by the way. So whether it has the Golden Gate Bridge in there or the Brooklyn Bridge, it's made in the same place. But people still like to buy snow globes to represent where they've been. So it all depends on what it is you want to buy. But there are things that are so quintessentially of that place. Messenger bags in San Francisco, we are well known for that. That's a historic, iconic part of our fashion uniform in San Francisco. And so the fact that they're made here is somehow more compelling than the fact that they might be made someplace else and imported to here.
I also want to note that this notion of people buying, you know, coming to the city and buying things. I mean, one of the advantages to having such a robust tourist economy is that it helps the city. Well, one of the reasons that people come to the city, or once they get here, want to spend money, is the local food business. It's the food trucks. It's all that. I mean, I think that's an area where San Francisco can market itself to the foodie community. And that's a big part of the city. You know, tourism is huge. And I think that giving people more reasons, it's, you know, you want to go to a city and get something. Well, if you're in a city where there really isn't anything distinctive about that city, not so great. In San Francisco, you really have these opportunities. I'd love to see people taking bus tours of some of the neighborhoods of San Francisco, not just go to Alcatraz and Fisherman's Wharf, but go to 24th Street or out to Potrero and see where people live and all that. I think there's a real draw there, and certainly the food culture is a huge part of that, and I think it's a real marketing opportunity for the city.
Yeah, is there, because the Bay Area is in the middle of such a rich food-producing state and region, how does that change the kind of opportunities your entrepreneurs have, Anne-Marie?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it just, just allows them the opportunity to really understand their place. I mean, I think that for us, when we're talking about competition, it is that you understand your competition in order to differentiate, right? So what is it about this product, right, this wonderful, authentic, home-style Mexican food that's going to differentiate itself from all the other Mexican food that exists out there in the Mission District. And so really working with entrepreneurs to have them understand what that point of difference is so that they can tell that story. And I think really a lot of this is it's about the story, about the connection that you feel, right? If you're a tourist and you're coming here and feeling just great about being able to take back this product in this bag because it has a story, or the food that you ate and understanding who it's come from and the story of the person who made it. I mean, I think that as humans, that connection and connecting with one another in the community is something that's really deep. And that you don't get when you go to these corporate chains.
Let me ask a bigger question. But we're coming up toward the end of our program, and we don't have a whole lot more time. So I'm going to make this our last question. But it's about reshoring, the idea of bringing manufacturing back from overseas, because companies may find that logistics issues or rising costs are making them think twice about the offshoring of manufacturing that they've done in the past, whether it's to Mexico or Philippines or whatever, or to China. And I appreciate that none of you three are really in that kind of a business model. But I wonder if the work you're doing makes the Bay Area a better place, a place where reshoring could more likely happen because people have changed the way they think about manufacturing here in the Bay Area. And even, let me start with you, Anne-Marie, maybe the least, the question that doesn't apply to you quite as much, but do you think people are changing the way they think about not just small-scale food making, but large-scale food making because of the work you're doing at La Cocina?
Yeah, I mean, I think that certainly there are a lot of people talking about the local food movement and really kind of, regional food movement for sure. And so I think the more kind of that we understand that, understand where our food is coming from, where it's how it's getting produced, allows for that, just more of that consciousness to be built. So.
Mm-hmm. And Hutt, you work with a lot of retailers, not thinking about the booksellers so much, but people who sell locally made products perhaps. Would they feel like, gee, wouldn't it be great if more of the stuff I could sell in my retail store was made here locally?
Well, yeah, I think that it's a huge... I think you can make it a real advantage, and I think that's one of when you talk about how do you compete, I think that you can make a great case for selling, whether it's local food or locally made products, all of that. If you can make the case to the consumer about why that has value, then it becomes, it really becomes a huge competitive advantage, becomes a huge business advantage for you. And I think that's something that we have an opportunity to really think about here, is that this environment that you're talking about does exist, and is there a way, frankly, to sort of capitalize on it and make the, the locally owned and reshoring coming back, make that, a real positive. I mean, when China had the toy problem, you saw all these toy manufacturers saying "Made in USA." I mean, that became the marketing. That's all you had to say. Is it not made in China? Is really all you had to say. But that became a positive. And I think there's a whole opportunity for businesses, both individually and collectively, to use that as a real advantage. And it is an advantage, and it will help. It will help San Francisco and the people living here, both economically and culturally and socially.
I want to tweak the question for you, Mark. When I first started doing reporting, it was mid-'80s, and I was covering Ignacio de la Fuente, the city council member, now leaving the city council, over in Oakland. But he was the head of a labor union fighting to save manufacturing jobs in the East Bay. And Transamerica de Laval was a big diesel engine maker. They're long gone. Tens and tens of thousands of jobs left the East Bay in the 80s, in the 70s and 80s. And in the 90s and the early 2000s, we lost manufacturing jobs in the South Bay. Elon Musk at Tesla has now taken over the empty NUMMI plant, and they're making electric cars there. So let me ask you the question again about reshoring. Does what SF Made does, how does that change the environment in the Bay Area and make people think twice about sending jobs offshore, make them think about doing them here in San Francisco or the Bay Area?
Well, I think it absolutely makes a difference and makes the Bay Area a more robust economy. I think that as manufacturing goes, so goes innovation. And so I think we've tended to think of technology and manufacturing as two different animals. And we've said, well, let the manufacturing go. You know, it's cheap labor is all that's required. Just make the stuff. We'll design it. We'll engineer it.
Yeah, Apple is not going to make their iPhones in the United States.
Maybe not. But I think that we are now coming face-to-face with the true state of affairs, that the innovators today are, in fact, the manufacturers who are making these things. And the technology companies that are offshoring at least are putting people in those factories to understand intimately how things are made so that they can co-innovate with their outsourced partners. I'm not a protectionist. I have nothing against outsourcing or offshoring other than the obvious social justice issues and environmental issues. So as you consider all of the externalities, not just the cost of labor, but the impact of factories that don't operate under the same constraints that we do in developed countries, then the equation becomes much different. You also see that wages are going up, in China in particular, and the workforce is aging and aging out of this generation that was almost forced to be in some of these factories, and the new generation is saying, look, I don't want to work in a sewing factory. I want to work in a technology business. And so you're going to see a huge shift in the economics that has driven offshoring, basically the chasing low-cost labor. And, you know, these things go in cycles. Originally, manufacturing was really dictated by your natural resources. What was close by, you used to make your stuff. And then when transportation became easy, then you chase something else. And today we chase labor because it's the final frontier on resources. And because everything else can move pretty freely. And so I think what we're doing to bring at least small-scale manufacturing back, or preserve what we have and grow what we have and bring and encourage entrepreneurs to start manufacturing locally is fantastic for the local economy.
Well, we have to close now. Thanks to our panelists, Mark Dwight, founder of SF Made, a nonprofit focused on building San Francisco's manufacturing sector, and the founder of Rickshaw Bagworks, Hutt Landon, executive director of the San Francisco locally owned Merchants Alliance, and Anne Marie Brown, operations director and organizational Gandalf at La Cocina, a local organization focused on helping local low-income food entrepreneurs reach economic self-sufficiency. I'm Cy Musiker, a news anchor at KQED and co-host of The Do List, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion is adjourned.